every strength flexed just a little too much becomes a weakness.
The Master. Ulwin Grimaldi was a man who believed in routine, and routine had always done well by him. Up early, paperwork dispatched at speed, the long list of necessary phone calls ticked off. As a small boy, he had been bullied into the routine of writing thank-you letters after Christmas and birthdays. It had stuck. Polite notes and an ability to remember the names of dull people, plus a pleasant smile, had helped him to rise silently, first as a journalist, then a Labour Party researcher, then an advisor, then an MP, then a minister, and finally Prime Minister. Routine meant that Ulwin Grimaldi was rarely surprised and never under-briefed about what to say. He had been expensively educated. For the first 24 years of his life, he had been tutored at home, at school, and at university in the long, self-confidently nasal vowels of the English ruling class. Then, as he contemplated public life, he had had almost equally expensive lessons in losing them again. He was taught the glottal stop and a certain laziness of the tongue which helped him fit in beautifully. He had read the right books at the right time, forgotten them again just as everybody else did, and ditched the wrong opinions with faultless precision. As early as his late 20s, he looked like a minister and he sounded like a minister. In opposition and in government, everybody knew he would be promoted and everybody was right. He accumulated an essential little store of self-deprecating stories, and even his least sincere smile could melt away resistance. He tied his ties in a perfect Windsor knot and never failed to floss his teeth or to clip his nails. Thus, it was a matter of general bafflement, not least to Ulwin Grimaldi himself, that he was failing so badly as a Prime Minister. This was due to something not just beyond his control, but beyond his imagination. To the fact that he had nothing interesting or novel to say about anything, and never had had. The country was bust, and people were angry. The British media talked constantly of a political crisis, or a fundamental malaise. What they really meant was that the people were in a right strop. Ulwin Grimaldi's talents for order and politeness, his clothes sense, even his self-deprecation were failing to calm them down. What was to be done? In the first place, he stuck by unflappable, reassuring routine. Routine knew what to do. Routine dictated that Ulwin Grimaldi invited a small number of prominent backbenchers and junior ministers for a drink in the White Drawing Room at No. 10 Downing Street at 6:30 p.m. on the first Wednesday of the month. The main point of this was to make the invitees feel better and, with any luck, warmer towards him. The secondary point was to discover whether any of them had something useful to say to him. His housekeeper chose the guests, and where possible, tried to introduce a theme. His housekeeper did this because Ulwin Grimaldi had no wife or partner to do it. Other than routine, Ulwin's great political secret had been an almost entire absence of sexual desire. From an early age, he had found the concept of bodily intimacy funny, and when not funny, disgusting. For grown men and women to think about one another's body parts, never mind shoes, stockings, lingerie, and innumerable other pathetic perversions, made them, in his view, ridiculous marionettes. Having never felt the slightest stirrings of lust, Ulwin Grimaldi calculated that he had between 20% and 50% more time to get on with politics than did his rivals. His secret nation was celibacy, that calm, temperate country without gales, without foolishness and mess, where scandal was never whispered. But this did mean that perhaps there was something slightly bloodless about Ulwin Grimaldi, and of course that he had to rely on his housekeeper, paid for by the taxpayer, to assemble his invitation lists. We may ask, was this entirely wise? Olwyn Grimaldi's housekeeper was called Eileen Wilkinson. She had looked after the master and his family during their years in Downing Street and at Chequers, retiring when the Conservatives came back to power. As soon as the Grimaldi government tottered into office, Mrs. Wilkinson had presented herself again at Number 10 and offered her services to the new Prime Minister. Olwyn liked to boast, "Mrs. Wilkinson moved smoothly from the master to me. She always says that things were much harder for her back then. I don't think she got on with the master's wife very well. I rely on her absolutely." Olwyn Grimaldi's confidence in Mrs. Wilkinson was based on two things: her utterly banal and expressionless exterior, and her occasional bitchy remarks about life with the master, to whom, he assumed, nobody could remain loyal. But we must ask again, was this entirely wise? On this particular MP's evening, the theme was women. The Grimaldi government had done moderately well on the women question. About a third of its cabinet ministers and nearly a third of its ministers generally were female, as were nearly half of the backbench MPs. But very few of Grimaldi's girls, Alwyn's angels hadn't flown, were much admired by the public. Like the man himself, they were polite, well turned out, said the right thing, and were smoothly forgettable. His press officer complained when broadcasters confused the names of the female ministers, but he did so only dutifully, for form's sake. This evening Mrs. Wilkinson had assembled more than 24 Labour women of different ages, backgrounds and talents. Even as she completed her list in ballpoint pen, however, she had found it hard to visualise those she was inviting. There was, however, one particular woman. Grimaldi had been strongly advised to promote Caroline Phillips by his permanent secretary, who had been a very junior civil servant in the Treasury during the master's years. He'd heard rumours that Mrs. Phillips was highly ambitious. But if there was one person on the planet unlikely to be susceptible to her famous charm, it would be the Prime Minister. Everyone in the room understood this, so everyone was watching as she arrived. Would this be a moment? A gentle but unmistakable glow of bronze-coloured light seemed to enter the drawing-room a yard before Caro did. Her glance laughed its way among the pillars, armchairs, and gathered MPs like a rebel-liberated beam of sunlight. Rival ministers, sour-faced backbenchers, and even Alwyn Grimaldi's housekeeper found delighted smiles playing on their faces without knowing quite why. Napes tingled, fingers rubbed excitedly on fingers. The room, which had been slightly chilly, warmed up nicely. Olwyn Grimaldi, feeling the warmth running down his back, turned around. In front of him, he saw an unremarkable-looking woman in a smart cream suit, whose eyes seemed to him to possess the candid gaze of a wild animal. A lioness, perhaps. As she looked at him, he seemed to see not her but himself through her eyes. A neat, light, stooping man with a smile of water. He felt very slightly sick, or excited, he couldn't tell which. Routine was being disturbed. He extended his damp palm. She smiled. "Prime Minister, what a pleasure! How kind! I've never been upstairs." "Mrs. Phillips, the pleasure is all mine. We should have had you round long ago. There are so many things I'd like to talk to you about." On their way out, as the drinks party ended an hour and a half later, Doreen Clarkson, the Northern Ireland secretary, said to Phoebe Marks, chair of the Public Accounts Committee, "I thought it was bloody rude. The two of them just stood there in the corner of the room yakketing away as if none of the rest of us were there at all." "If it were another man," said Phoebe, "I'd have said he was a little smitten." "Well, it's not that, at least," replied Doreen. "Though he did flush, I noticed. it's almost as if there's some blood in his veins after all. Still, rude. Terribly. Olwen Grimaldi and Caroline Phillips had not, in fact, been flirting. After a lifetime of subtle evasions, Olwen was incapable, while Caro, somewhat awestruck to be chatting to a prime minister, even this prime minister, was unaware of any effect she might have had on him. But they had been talking deeply, even intimately, about politics. Olwen had started his working life as a political journalist before hopping briskly over the fence. It was all those years of watching so many obvious mistakes and sordid scandals. There was never any possibility of me joining another party. My late father was a professor of politics and brought us up to read The Guardian. When I was 15, I was taken to a party to meet Polly Toynbee as a treat. She was wonderful, though I'm afraid she regards me as a bit of a disappointment these days. Oh, I'm sure she doesn't, Prime Minister. For me, I'm afraid it was really the New Testament. Do unto others easier for a camel and so forth. There has never been a more revolutionary call to arms, nor one so widely ignored. My partner, Angela, actually went into the church, but I'm too selfish for that. Or I wanted, I don't know, recognition or something. We all have mixed motives. That's why there are no good novels about the political trade. They bang on and on about the treachery and the double dealing, the vanity and the greed, but they never explain the other side. The real wish to do good. The decision to take less money and more abuse in return for a chance of helping people in the real world. Olwen feared that he was beginning to whine. Though, of course, we're very privileged to be here. Caro rescued him. Why are we on this planet? We're only here for a very short time, so how should we conduct ourselves? By being kind and helping others. I've always felt there were only two jobs that made any kind of moral sense. To be a politician in order to lead people, however uneasily and awkwardly, to better ways of living, or to be a priest. The last thing Olwen had expected was a serious conversation here in Downing Street. He felt excited. "That's rather good, Caroline. Would you mind if I..." "No, Prime Minister, be my guest. Although, to be strictly honest, I was quoting my partner who took the other path." Olwen had the retentive memory of a professional politician. "Angela, yes, of course. And now she has a living, how very Church of England to call it a living rather than a calling, up in Barker. Well, do you know, I'd love to meet her. I have a feeling, Caroline, that you and I can work rather closely together. I have some really quite worrying things on my mind, and why don't the two of you come and join me one weekend at Chequers, so we can all get to know one another better?" "Prime Minister, how very kind. But Angela is unbearable on Saturdays. She takes her sermons very seriously. Writes them all out in longhand herself."
"You could come on your own.
Or we could join you for Sunday lunch after the service. The drive down from Barker can't be more than an hour."
Olwen found himself feeling slightly disappointed. In the country,